This is Audible.
Dove Audio presents Dave Barry in Cyberspace by Dave Barry for Hubert and Ms. Potato, with special thanks to Crow. Introduction. You need to know right off the bat that I'm a total computer geek. I'm pathetic. You've seen all those computer magazines with names like Data Dweeb and cover headlines like Inside, explicit color photographs of big hard drives, or wax your modem for improved speed. No doubt you've asked yourself, what kind of no-life loser actually reads these magazines? I do, all of the time. I read them in bed. I look at the pictures of new computer systems and become moderately aroused and say things like, whoa, check out the 6x SCSI 2 CD-ROM drive on that baby. I'm always on the lookout for a new computer to replace my current one when it becomes obsolete, which usually happens before I can get it all the way out of the box. I'm not proud of this, but I have owned more than 20 computers, all of them fortunately tax-deductible, dating back to the early 1980s when I got one of the first primitive Radio Shack models, which looked like a mutant toaster oven that had been exposed to atomic radiation and developed a keyboard. This computer had virtually no practical use other than to consume electricity. You know how modern personal computers contain a microchip brain that, despite being no larger than a chiclet, can perform millions of mathematical calculations per second? Well, I don't think my Radio Shack computer had one of those. I think there might have been an actual chiclet in there calling the shots, because this, frankly, was not a gifted computer. I would not have put my money on this computer in a head-to-head IQ test against a doorknob. I had two programs for my Radio Shack, a word processor, and a game where you were a spaceship commander trying to destroy invading alien spaceships. In terms of enhancing my personal productivity, there was essentially no difference between these two programs. Both were very difficult to get working, both frequently stopped working for no apparent reason, and both had insanely obscure instructions that were written neither by nor for human beings. Quote, to delete a word, you must first enter the command mode by pressing the slash key, followed by the percent key, followed by the key with that little squiggly thing, followed by the first 5 digits of your social security number, followed by... It was impossible to use these programs for more than a few minutes without seriously screwing up and losing an important document, or even worse, your spaceship. But I loved that computer. I spent many happy hours cursing at it. I even learned to program it a little bit. At one point, I spent hours writing a simple program that made the computer count. When I ran the program, numbers would appear on the screen in a sequence like this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and so on, until the chiclet pooped out. I ran this program over and over. I was proud of myself for developing this innovative way to utilize my data processing resources to do my counting for me automatically, thereby freeing me to devote my valuable time to the important task of shopping for a new computer. Of course, today I have a far more powerful computer containing numerous important computer things, such as megahertz and megs of RAM, and I use it for many vital tasks other than counting. For example, I'm writing this book on a computer that is running the hugely popular Windows 95 trademark operating system, which has revolutionized the software world thanks to its capability of accomplishing the seemingly impossible task of making Bill Gates even richer than he already was. I love Windows 95 trademark because, first of all, it is so unbelievably complicated that I will never, ever, in 1 trillion years, really figure it out. This is an important feature for us computer geeks who would much rather spend our time diddling with our computers than using them to do something productive. If you don't believe this, pick up a copy of Byte, B-Y-T-E, magazine. This is the real name, I swear. Pick it up sometime and read a column in there by a guy named Jerry Purnell. Jerry is an author and a famous computer guru, and every month his column has basically the same plot, which is, 1. Jerry tries to make some seemingly simple change to one of his computers, such as connect it to a new printer. 2. Everything goes hideously wrong, and the computer completely stops working. Sometimes several of his other computers also stop working. Sometimes there are massive power outages all over the West Coast. Poor Larry spends days trying to get everything straightened out. 3. Finally, with the help of customer service and other computer experts all over the world, Jerry gets his computer working again approximately the way it used to, and he writes several thousand words about it for Byte. I swear it's virtually the same plot month after month, and yet it's a popular column in a magazine that appeals primarily to knowledgeable computer people. Why? Because Jerry's coming right out and admitting that we knowledgeable computer people primarily use our computers for messing around. Windows 95 trademark, being virtually impossible for a normal human to comprehend, is ideal for the purpose. Also, thanks to its advanced graphical capabilities, Windows 95 trademark enables you to put the little trademark sign after Windows 95. In fact, you can put all kinds of little things in there, such as Windows 95 registered, Windows 95 unhappy face symbol, Windows 95 time bomb symbol, and of course, Windows 95 Bill Gates' wiener. I'll have more to say about dressing up your documents in the chapter on word processing, or how to press an enormous number of keys without ever actually writing anything. And here's another important capability that I have thanks to the powerful studliness of my computer and Windows 95 skull and crossbone symbol. I can do multitasking, which means I have the ability to run several programs at the same time, which means I can waste time faster than ever before. For example, as I'm writing this chapter, I am also running a program called SimTower, trademark registered copyright, in which you can build this simulated building with little simulated elevators, escalators, offices, hotel rooms, and so on, and then all these little simulated people come, and you have to try to keep them safe and happy. This is not easy. In fact, during the preceding paragraph, when I was trying to solve the complex word processing problem of how to make the skull and crossbones mark, I received an urgent message informing me that a terrorist had planted a bomb in my building and was demanding that I pay $1 million ransom. Also, I have office workers demanding parking spaces, and a number of my hotel rooms have been invaded by roaches the size of Rush Limbaugh. Registered. Right now, I'm dealing with these problems and writing this informative book about computers and using a program called ABM Commander to protect several cities from nuclear destruction and checking my email to get important guidance, such as where the hell is my computer book, from my editors. Thanks to the miracle of computers, I am able to accomplish all of these tasks simultaneously in stark contrast to famous authors of the pre-computer era, such as Chaucer, who had to stop writing altogether when he wanted to play ABM Commander. Also, he had to use a manual typewriter. My point is that I have learned to use my computer as a productive tool in my everyday life, and you can too, by applying the many helpful tips and practical techniques that you'll find in this book, Dream On. Also, you can find out how to get on the internet and make contact with hundreds, even thousands of people whom you would otherwise never have had anything to do with voluntarily. But even if you don't use a computer, even if you're just an ordinary human being or a member of the legal profession, this book can help you better understand computers, these amazing devices that play such an important role in your life every minute of every day, from the moment at 6 a.m. each morning when you punch your clock radio to make it shut up. Think about it. Inside that clock radio is a miniature computer, an electronic brain that, despite being no larger than the reproductive organs of a standard female mosquito, is capable, thanks to the miracle of microcircuitry, of understanding not only basic commands such as on, off, and alarm, but also advanced data processing concepts such as snooze. And that's just the beginning. As clock radios become more intelligent, they'll start to actually anticipate your actions. Even as you read these words, top appliance scientists are working on a prototype clock radio of tomorrow that will have little feet so that after it sounds the alarm, it can dart around the nightstand evading your fist. Eventually, your clock radio will be so smart that it will figure out after being punched a few times that you don't really want to wake up at 6 a.m. Instead of sounding the alarm, it will tiptoe quietly out of the room, telephone your workplace, and mimicking your voice, inform your employer that you're quitting. A utopian pipe dream, you say? An overly optimistic scenario of life in the high-tech future? I don't think so. Not when we consider the many incredible benefits that we are receiving from computers right now, today, in virtually every area of our everyday lives, including medicine. Every day, in every town, there are heartwarming stories like this one. A 53-year-old man suddenly starts experiencing severe chest pains and shortness of breath. An ambulance rushes him to a hospital where, as his condition rapidly worsens, doctors administer a series of tests, the results of which are instantaneously transmitted via a special fiber-optic telephone cable to a giant medical database computer 1,000 miles away. Almost instantaneously, an electronic message comes back, informing the doctors that the patient, whom the computer has mistaken for another man with a similar name who actually died 38 months earlier, has fallen behind in his car payments and should be denied credit at the hospital. The computer then, without even having to be asked, disconnects the patient's electrical and phone services and cancels every one of his credit cards. All this is accomplished in less time than it takes you to burp. Transportation. When you fly on a commercial airline, you experience the security and comfort of knowing that even though you may be 35,000 feet in the air, traveling at over 500 miles an hour under conditions of obscured visibility, not one single passenger on your airplane paid the same fare as any other passenger. How is this possible? It's possible because the airline industry uses powerful and extremely imaginative fare-inventing computers, which are constantly being improved as the airline industry works toward the day, and this will happen in your lifetime, when every single airline passenger pays a different fare from every other passenger on every other flight in history. Just recently, in a breakthrough step toward this goal, a Chicago attorney wishing to fly to Philadelphia was required to pay 2 cows and a goat. This ticket required a Saturday night stayover with 2 sheep penalty for any changes. Communications. Today, most of us take it for granted that if we urgently need to reach a person, no matter where that person is in the world, we can simply press a few buttons on a telephone keypad, and within microseconds, thanks to the computerized global satellite telecommunications network, be connected with a microprocessor-controlled multifunction voicemail machine informing us that the person is not available. But that is only part of the story. Thanks to computers, inanimate objects are now able to contact us. I'm not referring here to the computers that call us up at exactly dinner time to ask us pre-recorded consumer survey questions about our views on, for example, laxatives, nor am I referring to the highly personalized letters that we receive from computers that know our name and are not about to let us forget it. Dear Mr. Dave Barry, have you, Mr. Dave Barry, ever stopped to think about what would happen to your family, the Mr. Dave Barry family, in the tragic event that you, Mr. Dave Barry, were to tragically become involved in an accident resulting in the loss of one or more of your Mr. Dave Barry's key arms and or legs? Well, we here at Mutual General Admiral Mineral Insurance spend most of our time worrying about exactly this. We sure hope that Mr. Dave Barry has adequate coverage, are our exact words, which is why today we want to offer you, Mr. Dave, the specific example of computer communication that I'm thinking of here is a widely publicized, absolutely true 1995 news story. You might have read about this. About a woman in Billerica, Massachusetts, who had an 800 telephone number for her home business, on which she received a mysterious telephone call every 90 minutes, day and night, for 6 months. She'd answered the phone, but there was never anybody there, only silence. It was driving her crazy, but she didn't want to disconnect the phone because she was afraid she'd lose business. Finally, she contacted the authorities, who tracked down the source of the calls, which it turned out to be, I swear I'm not making this up, an unused oil tank in the basement of a home in Potomac, Maryland. This tank was equipped with a computerized device programmed to call a fuel company when the tank was empty, but the fuel company had shut down, and its phone number was reassigned to the Massachusetts woman's business. In other words, thanks to the miracle of computers, this woman was being harassed by an empty oil tank hundreds of miles away, a technological achievement that would have been considered impossible just a few short, the 60s, for example, only lasted 4 years, at least that's all I remember, decades ago. In any event, the oil tank is now disconnected, which is good, because otherwise it would probably have wound up registered to vote, and you know it's a Perot supporter. And speaking of voting, nowhere are the benefits we receive from computers more flagrant than in the area of government. Without computers, the government would be unable to function at the level of effectiveness and efficiency that we have come to expect. This is because the primary function of the government is, and here I am quoting directly from the U.S. Constitution, to spew out paper. This can be very time-consuming if you use the old-fashioned method of having human beings sit down and manually think about what each individual piece of paper is actually going to say. This is why today's government uses computers, which are capable of cranking out millions of documents per day without any regard whatsoever for their content, thereby freeing government employees for more important responsibilities, such as not answering their phones. I have here a perfect example of a government computer in action, brought to my attention by Joyce Evans of Larkspur, California, who sent me a copy of a computerized notice that her son, a graduate student, received from the Internal Revenue Service. This notice, entitled Request for Tax Payment, states that her son's tax return showed that his total tax withheld, plus other payments, totaled $1,518.90, but his total tax due was $1,519. In other words, Joyce's son was 10 cents short on his taxes. Now, if a human being were dealing with this matter, he or she might, you always run this risk with humans, actually think about it, and he or she might come to the conclusion that it's stupid to waste government resources hassling an obviously honest taxpayer over 10 lousy cents. The problem with this kind of thinking, of course, is that if you let one taxpayer slide on his 10 cents, then you're going to let another one slide, and pretty soon you've let 10 million taxpayers avoid paying that final dime, which would mean that the federal government would have 1 million fewer dollars to spend on, for example, the Strategic Helium Reserve. Perhaps you don't believe we actually have a Strategic Helium Reserve. Perhaps you are a fool. But fortunately for the nation, a computer handled this situation. Without hesitating for a nanosecond, it fired off a notice informing the graduate student that he owed the 10 cents, plus a penalty of $12.41, plus interest of 78 cents, for a total of $13.29. And you can bet that the student paid it, because otherwise, if you don't believe this, you have never dealt with the IRS. The computer would order him to pay more money, and then more and more, until finally one morning he'd wake up to find his dormitory surrounded by federal tanks. This is why we taxpayers do whatever the IRS computers tell us. We know that once they get a cyber bee in their cyber bonnets, no power on earth can get it out. We're just hoping that the IRS computers don't start exchanging ideas with the airline fare computers, and we start getting tax notices ordering us to remit, say, 6 ducks plus a 2 chicken penalty. Education. Picture this scenario. It's 8 p.m. on a weekday night, and your 12-year-old child suddenly remembers that he has a major school report on the Spanish-American War due tomorrow. He needs to do some research, but the library is closed. No problem. Your cyber-savvy youngster simply turns on your computer, activates your modem, logs on the internet, the revolutionary information superhighway, and in a matter of minutes is exchanging pictures of naked women with other youngsters all over North America. I could go on and on, listing the ways in which computers enrich our everyday lives, but I've made my point, which is that we live in the computer age, and you need to get with the program. You are standing in the airport terminal of life, and the jet plane of the 21st century is about to take off. You must make a choice. Do you remain in the terminal, eating the stale vending machine food of outmoded thinking? Or do you get on the plane and soar into the stratosphere of computerization, swept along by the jet stream of evolving technology, enjoying the in-flight snack of virtually unlimited information access, secure in the knowledge that if you encounter the turbulence of rapid change, you are holding in this book the barf bag of expert guidance? That is the vision of tomorrow that I'm offering you. Come, take my hand. And together, let us explore this amazing new cyber world. If you don't know anything about computers, have no fear. I'm not going to bombard you with a bunch of technical gobbledygook. I'm going to present you with simple, practical, well-organized, easy-to-understand information, a lot of which I will make up as I go along. So let me just take a moment now to run this chapter through my computer spell checker, and then you and I can begin our fascinating journey into a brighter, better, and above all, more productive future. Chapter 1. A Brief History of Computing from Cave Walls to Windows 95. Not that this is necessarily progress. Early mathematics. The first human beings didn't need computers because they had no numbers. This was a big problem for parents because they had no way to control their children. You kids, stop that. I mean it. I'm going to count to... You kids, stop that. By the Paleolithic era, humans had discovered numbers. However, as we see from the cave writing reproduced below, they had no idea what the numbers meant. Imagine on a cave wall, graffiti-like letters that say, "Eat 4, suck my 32. Source, the British Museum. As you can imagine, these people sometimes took months to balance their checkbooks. It was the ancient Egyptians who first figured out that numbers could, if you added and subtracted them, be used to form mathematics. This made it possible, for the first time, to build the pyramids as well as keep score in bowling. From there, mathematics spread throughout the civilized world via camel, eventually reaching the ancient Greeks, who invented the cosine, although they never did figure out what it was for. The Greeks also produced the great thinker Pythagoras, who discovered that the tip equals 15%. From there, it was only a short step to the invention of trigonometry, although not all of us view this as a good thing. Very early computers. Some archaeologists believe that Stonehenge, the mysterious arrangement of enormous elongated stones in England, is actually a crude effort by the Druids to build a computing device. This theory is based on the fact that the stones, when viewed from above, form a distinct pattern, as we see in the following aerial photograph. As seen from above, formations forming words that seem to say, "Enter password colon." Source, NASA. Around the same time, 4:30 p.m., the Chinese invented the abacus, a wooden frame with colored beads on string that can be used to perform rapid mathematical computations. In the first practical use of the new technology, a Chinese merchant totaled up a sale on an abacus, which indicated that the customer owed the equivalent of $297 million for a pound of rice. This led to the invention of two key data processing expressions that are still widely used by businesses today. "We haven't worked out all the bugs," and "Can you come back later? Our abacus is down." Over the ensuing centuries, inventors continued to tinker with computing machines. In 1593, the brilliant German mathematician Klaus von Fauschenstrudel built a device that employed two knobs, which activated a series of gears and levers, which in turn controlled a stylus that left a record of its movements in the form of marks drawn in a tray of sand. After each session, these marks could be erased by simply shaking the tray to smooth the sand. This invention turned out to be completely useless for computing, but it ultimately led to the Etch-a-Sketch. The first modern computer. It should come as no surprise that the person who first conceived of the modern electronic computer was Leonardo da Vinci, the brilliant Renaissance thinker, who also had the original idea for virtually every other mechanical device we use today, including the helicopter, the ATM machine, Velcro, and the Thighmaster. In 1578, da Vinci sketched a diagram which, although simple, contains all the fundamental elements that we find in modern computers: keyboard, monitor, and everything. But it was not until centuries later, during the Industrial Revolution, that da Vinci's vision became a reality. The man responsible was inventor Elias Smerton, who in 1807 built his revolutionary steam-powered computer, the Data Bell, which featured a 14-ton floppy diskette that required 40 men and a team of horses to insert. Seeking to publicize his invention, Smerton staged a computer contest between his machine and one of the leading mathematicians of the day, John Henry LaFromage. in a dramatic demonstration of the awesome potential of automated data processing, the human competition was literally blown away when the data bell, attempting to add 2 and 7, exploded with such force that what was believed to be La Fromage's pancreas was found nearly 4 miles away. Clearly, nobody was going to stand in the way of this amazing new technology, but because of the extremely high cost and phenomenal inaccuracy of early computers, the only customer for them was the federal government. In 1890, for the first time, the government used computing machines to conduct the census. It was completed in a record 2 months, and it yielded much valuable information, including the startling fact that the United States had only 12 residents, all of them named Earl A. Snep. Well, as you'd expect, when the federal income tax was enacted in 1913, the Internal Revenue Service quickly embraced the computer. The model used by the IRS was a simple yet effective device that employed a bank of electrically charged nails and a series of cardboard cards with various patterns of holes punched in them. When the nails were pressed down onto a card, they passed through the holes and formed a complete electrical circuit by piercing the naked bodies of taxpayers who had been summoned for audits. But it was not until World War II that the U.S. government began to unleash the true power of this technology when our intelligence forces first employed computers to break enemy codes. Probably the most famous example concerns a top-secret cable sent from the Japanese military high command to Japan's ambassador in Washington on December 3, 1941. The cable, intercepted by U.S. agents, read, E. Will, Ilway, Attack A, Earl Pay, Arbor Hay, Tokyo. This cable was immediately fed into the U.S. War Department's top-secret code-breaking computer, codenamed Codebreaker, which consisted of thousands of interconnected electrical switches, or relays. Unlike human intelligence analysts, Codebreaker was able to work on a problem non-stop, 24 hours a day, never taking a coffee break, although it did go to the bathroom 4 times, until finally, in March of 1944, it gave up. Before it quit, however, Codebreaker was able to correctly identify Tokyo as a city in Asia, information that was to prove vital in the war effort. The next major advance came soon after the war with the construction of the first commercially available electronic digital computer, UNIVAC, which stands for IBM. This device, which contained 20,000 vacuum tubes, occupied 1,500 square feet, and weighed 40 tons. There was also a laptop version weighing 27 tons. UNIVAC was capable of performing 5,000 mathematical calculations per second, although it did get most of the answers wrong, which, although slow by today's standards, meant it was now possible for a single corporate employee to do something that formerly was impossible: play solitaire on the computer screen. The modern electronic office was born. Over the next 2 decades, computer usage became widespread in the commercial world, radically transforming the way business was done. Nowhere was the change more striking than in the area of paper. In the pre-computer era, virtually every business activity, no matter how trivial, resulted in the generation of a piece of paper. Now, thanks to electronic data processing, every activity, including office birth announcements, resulted in hundreds, sometimes thousands, of pieces of paper. Every serious business had a bank of industrial printers cranking away day and night, churning out endless rivers of perforated paper covered with detailed reports consisting of lengthy columns of numbers that no actual person would ever really look at. These reports were aged in huge warehouses in New Jersey and then converted into mulch, which was in turn used to grow new trees needed to meet the ever-expanding need for computer paper. But as important as these advances were, they were limited to the business community. Ordinary citizens had no direct contact with computers, and thus no way to personally experience the benefits of the new technology. All of this changed in the early 1970s with the introduction of the first truly practical personal data processing device, the Pong machine. Suddenly, people in bars who used to fritter away most of their time watching Hollywood squares could, without knowing anything about programming, use little electronic paddles to battle an electronic dot back and forth across the screen. Once Americans began to grasp the extent to which this invention had increased their personal productivity, it was only a matter of time before they demanded and got Pac-Man. Americans were becoming hooked on computers. The only problem was that these computers were found mainly in bars, required a quarter to operate, had very simple controls, and were useful mainly for playing games. Clearly, what was needed was a home-based computer that cost thousands of dollars, had complex controls, and would be useful mainly for playing games. And thus, the personal computer, or PC, was born. In the early days, different brands of computers used different operating systems, which meant that people switching from one computer to another would have to learn a completely new set of instructions. This was obviously inefficient. So in the early 1980s, most major computer manufacturers agreed to stop forcing people to learn a bunch of different operating systems and instead adopt a single, uniform, standardized operating system so absurdly non-intuitive that nobody could learn it. This system was called MS-DOS. The MS, of course, stood for Microsoft, the company that was started by the brilliant software genius Bill Gates. Gates is a very rich man today. Forbes magazine estimates that he's worth more than the entire O.J. Simpson defense team combined, and do you want to know why? The answer is one word, versions. To understand what I meant by versions, let's consider an analogy involving cars. Suppose you've purchased a new car, and you notice that, although it does move, it goes very slowly, is extremely hard to steer, and makes a loud scraping sound. You study this problem for a while, and you conclude that the most likely cause is that the car does not have any front wheels. So you mention this to the salesperson, and he tells you that you have version 1.0 of the car, but that version 1.1 will be out shortly, and it will feature wheels in front as well as back. So when version 1.1 comes out, you upgrade, which means you pay money. But you're happy because you have a car with a complete set of wheels, and you're totally satisfied with it from the moment that you pull out of the dealer's lot to the moment, about 90 seconds later, when you drive into a public fountain. This is when you find out that brakes are not scheduled to appear until version 1.3. This is very much the way MS-DOS worked. The original version, 1.0, did virtually nothing except cause the computer screen to say, A prompt, which is an A with a colon and a little arrow pointing to the right. That was it. Really. Ask anybody who used MS-DOS computers back then. You'd turn them on, and there'd be this A prompt staring back at you. What did it mean? Why A colon? Why not some other letter or even an actual word? And what was that little pointy arrow thing for? We will never know the answer. It is one of the many mysteries of MS-DOS. So anyway, people would turn on their computers and stare at the A prompt for a while, scratching their heads, and then finally they'd try typing something after the A prompt, perhaps something like, "Hello." But here was the crucial thing about MS-DOS version 1.0. No matter what you typed, it would respond as follows: bad command or file name. Then, with no further explanation, it would go back to A prompt. There were rumors, never verified, that if you typed in certain secret code words, you could get some response other than A prompt or bad command or file name. But if there were such code words, only Bill Gates ever knew what they were. So mainly what this version of the MS-DOS was used for, millions of person hours were spent on this, was trying to get it to do something, anything. If you travel back in time and look at the average person's computer screen during that era, you'd see what looked like a conversation between the computer user and an unusually hostile employee of the federal government. A prompt, hello, bad command or file name. A prompt, help, bad command or file name. A prompt, do something, bad command or file name. A prompt, run a program, damn it, bad command or file name. A, fuck you, bad command or file name, a-hole. This is pretty much all people did with MS-DOS version 1.0, so you can imagine how excited everybody was when Microsoft came out with version 1.1, which had a whole new capability. In addition to doing this, a-prompt, it would sometimes also do this, c-prompt. a new letter. This was very, very exciting news for those of us in the computer geek world. We all immediately upgraded to version 1.1. Of course, no matter what we typed in, it still answered bad command or file name. But we felt renewed hope. Over the next few years, Microsoft continued to come out with new, improved versions of MS-DOS, featuring a constantly expanding repertoire of incomprehensible and/or scary screen messages, including B-prompt, non-system disk or disk error, invalid switch, path not found, warning, all data will be lost, and just about everybody's all-time favorite, abort, retry, fail. We loyal micro geeks faithfully upgraded every time a new version came out until finally, somewhere around version 3.7, we had reached the point where we could use MS-DOS to actually run programs on our computers, and Bill Gates had reached the point where he had approximately 217 personal jet airplanes. I should point out that while all this was going on, there was another kind of computer developing in a parallel universe. This was the Apple. And it operated on an entirely different concept, which was, a regular human could use it. You simply turned it on, and immediately, just like that, you could do stuff with it. It had little pictures on the screen, and a little mouse that made a pointer move to the picture you wanted. Even a child could understand this. For many years, while we MS-DOS people were trying insanely obscure instructions like, directory C colon backslash ABC PROJ backslash docs backslash letters backslash sales backslash aper backslash asterisk dot asterisk. The Apple people were simply aiming their little mouse pointers at little pictures and going click. In short, the Apple was far easier to use, so the vast majority of us serious computer users rejected it. As I noted in the introduction, the main reason we have computers is so that we can be tormented by them. We don't want some wussy, user-friendly computer. We want a challenge. And that's why, to this very day, Apple is not considered by us cyber wonks to be a truly serious computer. It is viewed as a computer that is popular mainly with your flaky or artsy-fartsy type of individual, your artist, your poet, your beatnik, your flower arranger, your heroin addict. We serious users pride ourselves on wrestling with openly hostile computers that are running an operating system from the proud, incomprehensible Microsoft tradition. That operating system, of course, is Windows. Registered. Copyright. Trademark. As I write these words, the computer world is still reverberating with the excitement surrounding the introduction of Windows 95, registered, copyright, trademark, which replaces Windows version 3.11, registered, copyright, trademark, which replaced Windows 3.1, registered, copyright, trademark, which replaced Windows version 3.0, registered, copyright, trademark, and so on backward to the original Windows version 1.0, registered, copyright, trademark, which did nothing except put a colorful Windows registered, copyright, trademark logo on the screen along with a message that said, out of memory. Windows 95 registered copyright trademark represented a major step forward in the sense that it was virtually nothing like any of the earlier Windows registered copyright trademark versions, and nobody had any idea how to use it. Naturally, it was hugely popular. Everybody wanted it. Microsoft was getting bulk orders from primitive rainforest-dwelling tribes that didn't even have electricity. Inevitably, people began to figure out how to use Windows 95 registered copyright trademark to actually do things. Thus, the challenge facing software designers once again is to develop some creative new ways to thwart these users. And rest assured, they will do it. Even now, they're working on experimental programs that will spontaneously mutate into new 100% incompatible versions while they're running. And let's not forget the hardware manufacturers, who are constantly coming out with faster and more powerful computers in a relentless quest to render obsolete the computers they talked you into buying last month. Yes, we've come a long, long way from the days when prehistoric humans would write crude numbers on cave walls. How would these ancient ancestors react if we were to show them a modern computer? Probably they would beat it into submission with rocks. They were smarter than we realize.
Welcome.
Chapter 2, How Computers Work. Most of us are intimidated by computers. This is because computers involve electricity, which totally baffles us. We're still not sure how come it doesn't dribble out of the wall socket when we unplug an appliance. Answer: air pressure prevents this from happening. Source: Stephen Hawking. In fact, most of us are baffled by all electronic devices. Radio is a good example. We know that if we turn on the radio, it will start producing sounds such as the song Woolly Bully by Sam the Sham and the Pharaohs. If we were pressed to explain this, we'd probably parrot the explanation we got from our science teachers, which is that the radio is receiving radio waves. But the truth is that we have no idea what this means. We can't answer such fundamental questions as, what are radio waves? How come they don't make any noise when they go past our ears, causing us to hear snippets of Woolly Bully zipping by? How do they go through walls? Do they also go through our bodies? Do they penetrate our skulls and get trapped inside there and ricochet around? Is that why certain songs, usually songs we really hate, such as I Shot the Sheriff, get stuck in our heads? Also Seasons of the Sun. We can't answer any of these questions. The pathetic truth is that if our science teachers had told us that radios work because they contain tiny nuclear-powered singing hamsters, we'd repeat that too. We know nothing about technology and cannot explain the principles involved in even the most basic labor-saving devices such as the salad shooter. So we naturally assume that computers are way beyond our comprehension. But that is not necessarily the case. In fact, computers operate on simple principles that can be easily understood by anybody with common sense, a little imagination, and an IQ of 750. So let's put on our thinking caps now and get right to our discussion of how computers work. The first thing that happens is that electricity goes into the computer. The electricity is supplied by the wall socket, which is in turn connected to the electrical company via big overhead wires with squirrels running on them. A question many people ask after a couple of martinis is, how come the squirrels don't get electrocuted? To answer that question, we need to understand exactly what an electrical circuit is. When you turn on a switch, electricity flows through the wire into the appliance, where it is converted via a process called electrolysis into tiny microwaves. These fly around inside the oven area until they locate the hungry hombre heat-and-eat hearty burrito entree, and then they signal the location to each other by slapping their tails in a distinctive pattern. The workers, or drones, then penetrate the fallopian tubes and swarm around the queen. This causes the rapid warming that makes the entree edible and leads via amino acids to digestion. This is followed by grunting and flushing, with the outflow traveling via underground pipes to the sewage treatment plant, which in turn releases purified water into the river, where it is used to form waterfalls, which rotate the giant turbines that produce the electricity that flows through the wires back to your appliance, thereby completing the circuit. So we see that squirrels have nothing whatsoever to do with it. There is no need for you to worry about squirrels. Believe me, they are not worrying about you. A much more productive use of your time, in my opinion, would be to focus your attention on the question at hand, which is, how computers work. Computers are essentially counting machines, but they do not count the way we do. We use what mathematicians call the base 10 numbering system, which means that we go 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on until we reach 10. And after that point, we can no longer use the express lane. Granted, there are gray areas. For example, if you're buying two rutabagas, you can count them as one item, because the cashier is going to weigh them as one item and then ring them up as one item. But the same does not hold true for cereal. If you're buying a box of shredded wheat and a box of Fruit Loops, that is clearly two separate items. Please don't try to tell me, but they're both cereal, so really it's just one item. The Supreme Court rejected that argument years ago. The specific case was Mrs. Bernice A. Wackerdorfer versus a bunch of really angry people waiting in line behind her. Oh, yes. I've stood behind extra item people like you in checkout lines. I know your little tricks. You get in the express lane with your 10 items that are really closer to 15 or 16 items, and then you just reach the cashier. You suddenly realize that you forgot some vital item on your list, and so the entire express lane has to stand there twiddling its thumbs while you send your 8-year-old child off on a scavenger hunt to find the Cheese Whiz Light, which, to judge how long your child is gone, is located somewhere in the Amazon River Basin. And when your child finally returns, you send him or her back because he or she brought the 16-ounce jar, and your coupon, of course you have coupons, is good only for the 12-ounce jar. And when you finally are ready to pay, then and only then do you start rooting around for your checkbook. Of course, you pay by check, and then you ask for your pen, and then you can't find your driver's license, and then you ask what the date is, and then you want a check to make sure that the cashier also deducted the coupon for the Happy Tabby liver and chocolate cat treats. And don't you see what you're doing to the people behind you? Don't you realize that you're only seconds away from being attacked by a crazed mob armed with potentially lethal groceries? Do you have any idea how much damage can be inflicted on the human body by a frozen Cornish game hen? No, you're not thinking about all that, are you? You're stuck in your own self-centered, short-sighted little world, and it would never occur to you to consider any of the broader issues affecting society and the future of mankind, such as how computers work. The key thing to understand is that computers do not count the way we do. Instead of the basic 10 system, computers use what mathematicians call the binary system, in which there are only two numbers, 0 and 1. In some ways, this is a disadvantage for computers. For example, they are incapable of doing this cheer. 2, 4, 6, 8, who do we appreciate? Instead, computers have to cheer thusly. 1, 0, who's our hero? This cheer is not nearly as effective. Which is why, although computers are getting really good at chess, they still suck at football. But the binary system enables the computer to perform certain tasks far more efficiently than the human brain can. For example, the average human can take up to a half an hour to remember and sing the 12 days of Christmas. Even then, the human is likely to include incorrect elements, such as 11 lads squatting. Whereas a computer, using the binary system, has to sing only the one line about the partridge in the pear tree. The difference is even more dramatic for 99 bottles of beer on the wall. Of course, you, the computer user, do not see just ones and zeros on your computer screen. You see all the normal numbers, plus all the letters, plus, if you're taking advantage of the vast array of multimedia informational resources available on the internet, dirty pictures. Where do all these things come from? What's going on inside that magic box on your desktop? To answer these questions, we really do need to explore in depth the question of how computers work. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to answer a complicated question like this in the small amount of space remaining in this chapter. Briefly, though, what appears to happen is this. The electricity goes into the computer where there are parts that do the actual computing. I frankly have no idea how they do it, but if I had to guess, I'd say it involves radio waves. Chapter 3. How to buy and set up a computer. Step 1. Get Valium. If you're a novice in cyberspace, you may think that buying a computer is a scary and confusing process. But the truth is that if you take a little time to learn a few basic principles and some of the technical lingo, buying the right computer and getting it to work properly is no more complicated than building a nuclear reactor from wristwatch parts in a darkened room using only your teeth. So let's get started. What kind of computer do I need? Experts agree that the best type of computer for your individual needs is one that comes on the market about 2 days after you actually purchase some other computer. Computer manufacturers have agents monitoring your home at all times. The instant you come home with a newly purchased computer, these agents use their wrist radios to contact the manufacturer and say, "Your name, just bought a computer. It's time to come out with a much better one with way more features for the same price," so that your name will feel like a great big consumer boner head. I know, they've done this to me dozens of times. Note, perhaps you think you can trick them by bringing home an empty computer box and remarking to yourself out loud, "Here I am, bringing home a new computer that I just purchased." Don't be a fool. They have X-ray glasses. How much should my computer cost? About $350 less than you will actually pay. What size of computer should I get? You need to decide whether you want a desktop or a laptop. A desktop computer has the advantage of pretty much covering your entire desk, so that in the office environment you can duck behind it and pick your nose. Desktop computers also have bigger screens, which are better if you're the type of power user who runs a lot of graphics-intensive data processing applications such as golf. Pick your finger out of your nose when you putt. Also, desktop computers provide an excellent inter-office communications capability because you can stick post-it notes on the screens. Laptop computers don't have the same display quality, but they do pack an astounding amount of computing power into a lightweight, notebook-sized unit that is unbelievably easy to steal. Also, they operate on batteries, which means that you can take your computer anywhere, on a boat, to a remote cabin, on the Space Mountain ride, and so on, and have it suddenly stop working because these are special batteries that need to be recharged about every 20 minutes. I carry my laptop computer everywhere, and I found it to be an invaluable tool for getting into deadly no-escape conversations with friendly people sitting next to me on long plane trips. You know, those disturbingly friendly Forrest Gump-like people who get on cross-country flights with absolutely nothing to read or do, so that after they've studied the barf bag, this takes them about 20 minutes, they start to prey leech-like on the passengers around them for entertainment. I am always, apparently it's an FAA regulation, seated next to these people. When I pull out my laptop computer, they become fascinated. And why not? It's even more interesting than a barf bag. They stare at it for a while, and then we have a conversation like this. Friendly person, gesturing at the computer, which is obviously a computer. Is that a computer? Me. Yes. Having determined that we are really hitting it off, the friendly person leans over and peers closely at the screen. I really, really hate it when people look at what I'm writing. Much of the time, I don't even want to look at what I'm writing, because it's usually some semi-random collection of words desperately trying to form themselves into a joke. I try to appear busy so that the friendly person will realize that I'm working and leave me alone. But this never happens. Friendly person. "So, what are you doing?" Me. Writing. I turn busily back to my computer, although now I can't think of anything to write because I'm just waiting for the friendly person to say, "Friendly person, what are you writing?" Me. A newspaper column. Now, of course, the friendly person wants to read the column. I try to turn the computer screen away from him, but this only causes him to lean over even closer so that he's practically in my seat. Friendly person, reading. "What's a boger?" Me. "It's not a boger, it's a booger." Friendly person, loud enough so that other passengers turn to look. "Booger?" Me. "Yes." Friendly person, a little suspiciously. "What kind of newspaper do you work for?" My feeling is if the airlines want to appeal to the frequent flyer, they should stop advertising that they have comfortable seats and start advertising that they have ejection seats. Where should I buy my computer? One option is to go to one of those giant discount electronics warehouses where they sell computers along with every other kind of household appliance. The problem here is that the sales staff, because they also have to handle refrigerators, stereos, and so on, might not be highly knowledgeable about computers per se. You say, "Can you tell me about this computer?" Salesperson, "Sure. This is an excellent computer with, let's see..." He reads from the card on the computer. "Okay, this one has 4 MB RAM. You, "What does that mean?" Salesperson, "Well, it's basically a measurement of the amount of RAMs that this particular computer has, which relates to the magnetism. This computer has 4 MB of them, which is excellent. I have 4 at home myself. So you want it?" You, "Okay, I guess." Salesperson, "I strongly recommend the auto defrost option." In recent years, 1993 and 1995, just to name two, we've seen the growth of a new breed of superstores with names like Comp Yo Mama and Crazy Walter's House of Data, devoted solely to computers. You walk into one of those huge spaces and you see hundreds of computer systems, all of which look pretty much alike, except that they have different prices. In fact, they are alike.